I had a remarkable experience last night. I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, know who Daniel Pearl was. The journalist from Encino, my neighbor who lived around the corner, who was captured and beheaded on camera in Afghanistan some years ago. Last night I had the opportunity of driving his father, Dr. Judea Pearl, to the Los Angeles Press Club Awards Banquet, where he gave the award for courage in journalism, tragically, posthumously, to the Russian reporter who was covering human rights abuses in Russia and in Chechnya, who was murdered. Receiving the award from Dr. Pearl was her editor, Sergei, and he shared that 282 Russian journalists have died in the last decade. No prosecutions, no arrests. It's a dangerous world out there. What made my experience extraordinary, however, was the opportunity to spend quiet time with Dr. Pearl. I picked him up at his home and drove him to the event. Remarkable man. Remarkable father. He is not a religious person in any of the traditional ways. He is not what anyone of an Orthodox persuasion would call a believer, except a believer in life and a believer in art and a believer in music and a believer in love. He's driven to keep the memory of his son's life, not death, alive. And he does this by being involved in interfaith dialogue, by being involved in the creating of musical events and experiences, and the commissioning of music. What he is doing is, in a sense, a metaphor for what I think we all do, and that is to try to either extract, uncover, or create meaning to life, to loss, to suffering, to all of those things that we normal human beings experience in the course of our lives. All of us know, and it is no great revelation to understand, that love and loss and fear all go together. They are each other's price. If we don't love, if we don't care, if our hearts aren't out there with extraordinary vulnerability, we may have protected ourselves, but from what? From the greatest things that life can offer us. And whether this is the love of a father to son, or father to daughter, or daughter to father, whatever our relationships are, it is in that giving and that horrible, terrifying vulnerability that we become alive and we search for a sense of meaning. Of how is it that we make this kind of love, that we take these kinds of risks, that we deal with life, not the possibility, but the certainty and inevitability of loss, and then find some kind of healing. My time with Dr. Pearl is just really extraordinary because I don't know how a soul lives through those kinds of experiences. All of us live with loss, but we mostly have plausible deniability and not the videotape of somebody we love being beheaded and being emotionally tortured before physically tortured. How do we heal our hearts from that kind of loss? And the fact that he can go on without bitterness, he can go on with a positive vision, he can go on trying to make music and build bridges, says something about the potential for every human being in this room and every human being on this planet. We do not have to be destroyed by pain and live in fear of constant fear of loss. We don't have to protect our hearts, but we can trust our hearts to be healed if we trust each other into our hearts. In the beginning of the Bible, there is my favorite quote and question, where Adam and Eve are noshing in the garden and have the fruit, and it wasn't on the menu or in season, apparently. And as soon as they had the fruit, they understood that they had committed what in normal language is called a big no-no, and they went and they hid out in the bushes. More stuff about bushes. I'm following with Patrick's non-political reference to Bush. And God asks an interesting question. God says, "Where are you?" And what's interesting is that it's not a question that was ever understood as showing the absence of God's knowledge. It was more like the question that a parent might ask a child, or very much the same my wife might ask me. What were you thinking? It was a question directed not for the absence of information of the questioner, but the absence of being present to themselves of the person being questioned. Because what's interesting is that every other time in the Hebrew Scriptures, when God asks, "Where are you?" the answer in the Hebrew is "Hinani," "I'm here." "I'm here" is, I think, the proper response for almost all occasions. I'm here to be with you, to accompany you, to be part of our lives. That's what we are to each other. When a former head of the Unitarian Universalist Association once gave a sermon, and he asked, "What do Unitarian Universalists have to say to the dying, because we don't have a normative theology? We have all kinds of beliefs. We have a huge spectrum, so we don't have a catechism that ministers learn and go, well, here's the formula that you recite to the dying." He didn't have an answer. But the answer that almost every clergy person knows is, "I'm here. I'm here not to fix the problem, because there are problems that are not fixable. I'm here not because I have the answers, because I don't. I'm just here to be present, to be together." I think that's what parenting is about, largely. I think that it was a wonderful tribute that parents don't need to have examples and don't need to have answers. I had very few answers when I was a parent, but I thought it was important to spend time, because time is truly the only important gift that we have to give each other. Time is the most precious thing we have. It is what we have in life, in this flash of brightness between what may be two eternities of darkness, or maybe there's something else. But we know that this flash of light is cosmically brief. And so when we spend time, we are spending the greatest of our treasures. One of the problems that fathers have is, not surprisingly, a problem that men have. Men tend to want to fix things. We tend to feel some sense of responsibility to somehow intuitively know how things work. To be engineers, to be handymen. We don't have to go take a class on how to use power tools. We know how to use power tools. You women have to take a class because this is just the price you pay for not taking the class or reading the manual, but that's a guy thing. We're supposed to instinctively know how to do that. We're supposed to have all of these kinds of answers, and we want to fix stuff. So, in emotional situations where there isn't a good answer, where somebody is sick and you're not a doctor, when somebody is suffering and you don't have a formula to make it go away, when somebody is angry or lonely or frightened and you don't know what to say, "Hinani, I'm here" is an awfully good response. What we can do as people and as parents is simply to be present, to keep each other company. In the 60s, we used to wonder about whether the great things in life were the peak experiences, those great kinds of changes from the ordinary routine. Those are the things that we'll remember. Never mind the day-to-day drudgery. Go for the peak experience, and peak experiences are wonderful. I loved peak experiences in the 60s, and now that I'm in my 60s, I still enjoy peak experiences, but I get a little winded by the time I get to the peak. But they're still important. But so is the day-to-day being there with each other, being there for each other, the time that we spend together. And I guess as I have gotten older, and arguably, at least I'd argue, my wife may have an opposing and responsible other opinion, more mature, I don't think that it's either or. I think that it is both and. I want the peak experiences, and I treasure the day-by-day routine and rhythm of life. It is really where we spend our lives with each other in the day-to-day. Not necessarily the dull, but the ordinary miracle of how we spend this precious time with each other. Once upon a time, we talked about, I want to spend quality time with my kids. I want to compact that time into such great quality that I won't really need to be hours. I can do it in minutes. This is a little bit like when we redid the house and we moved into the apartment, and my wife tried to compact 5 walk-in closets into 1 closet. It wasn't that successful. Or she asked me why I couldn't get all of the water from my 120-gallon fish tank into a 50-gallon fish tank. And I tried to explain that water just doesn't compress that easily, but neither does quality time. I don't think you may be able to speed date, but I don't think that you can speed parent. Our children learn who we are by what we do, not what we say, by the time that we spend, the quality and the length of that time, and not simply what we tell them our priorities are. And our children also learn about our priorities by how we treat our parents or treated our parents and the time that we spent with them and the quality of that time and the quality of our interaction with our parents. It is always foolish to believe that our children are not watching and that they are not learning and that they are not intuiting the most important examples from our example. Frankly, that's the reason we have a food collection. So our children here can see that we are not only for ourselves. We can talk every day about generosity towards others, but to do something symbolic and real is tremendously important. To show consciously how we value others by how we spend the treasure of our time with them is extraordinarily valuable. When I think back on some of my peak experiences with my father, I think of all the time that he broke the rules. And I treasure those broken rules, because they showed to me a sense of caring and a sense of his priorities. When the first rocket was going up, Dad said, "Stay home from school and watch that rocket. This is something historic." When this may not be quite as historic to some of you, but when the first Dodger game was played at the Los Angeles Coliseum, my father took me out of school. When the first Angel game was played in Wrigley Field in Los Angeles, my father took me out of school. You may discern a pattern here. When the Dodger Stadium opened, yes, my father took me out of school. And those days of missed school are some of the most important peak experiences of my life. They were choices, and they were talking about the priority of how you spend time together. And I treasure all of those. There are other peak experiences where he picked me up and paddled my butt. And that is equally memorable because it taught me valuable lessons about how you treat a parent when he's filling out his income tax form. And only three warnings of please go away, don't bother me before things could get a little strange. It was the only time I was ever hit. And I learned very many important lessons from that. We carry our people, our parents, our children, with us our entire lives. We have opportunities to take them into our hearts and to carry them around. And there are almost always opportunities about what we remember, whether we carry the blessing or the curse, because nobody's legacy is simple. All of the saints in our families had sins, and all of the sinners in our families did some wonderful things. And so we have amazing power to pick and choose with some sense of reality how it is that we carry the people whom we have loved and who have loved us. They don't go away. We don't exorcise them. Denial is seldom one of the really effective ways of dealing with reality. Most of us tried that sometime or other in our lives, and it usually doesn't work. But choosing the gifts that we take from the past, choosing to be blessed as against cursed, to learn from their mistakes and not repeat them, to be conscious and to be present. It's interesting to me that the word that we use for atonement comes literally, and it's not a preacher's trick, from at-one-ment. It is taking those broken parts, those imperfect parts of ourselves, and bringing them together. It is also taking those broken and imperfect parts of our relationships, the mistakes that we made as parents, the mistakes that we made as children, and becoming at one with the people when that's possible, and with the memories, which is almost always possible. To find peaceful chambers in our hearts, to carry the memories of those who have touched our lives, to understand that the most important thing that we have is time. The most important gift that we give is time. The most important words that we say to each other is not, I can fix it, I can do it, but I am here. I will walk with you. I will sit with you. I will think of you. I will hold you in my arms. I will hold you in my thoughts, in my prayers, and in my heart. We say that to our children for the future, to our parents in the past, and to each other today.